David Copperfield by Charles Dickens. Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life, or whether that station will be held by anybody else, this story must show. To begin my life with the beginning of my life, I record that I was born on a Friday at 12 o'clock at night. I was born at Blunderstone in Suffolk. I was a posthumous child. My father's eyes had closed upon the light of this world 6 months when mine opened on it. An aunt of my father's, and consequently a great aunt of mine, was the principal magnate of our family. Miss Trotwood, or Miss Betsy, as my poor mother always called her, had been married to a husband younger than herself, who was strongly suspected of having beaten Miss Betsy, and even of having once made some determined arrangements to throw her out of a window. These evidences of an incompatibility of temper induced Miss Betsy to pay him off. She took her maiden name again, bought a cottage in a hamlet on the seacoast, and was understood to live secluded in an inflexible retirement. My father had once been a favourite of hers, I believe, but she was mortally affronted by his marriage on the ground that my mother was a wax doll. She'd never seen my mother, but she knew her to be not yet 20. This was the state of matters on the afternoon immediately prior to my birth. My mother was sitting by the fire, but poorly in health, and very low in spirits, and desponding heavily about herself and the fatherless little stranger, who was already welcomed by some grosses of prophetic pins in a drawer upstairs. Lifting her eyes to the window opposite, she saw a strange lady coming up the garden. "Mrs. David Copperfield?" said the stranger, when she had been admitted. "Yes," said my mother faintly. "Miss Betsy Trotwood," said the visitor. "You have heard of her, I dare say?" My mother answered she had had that pleasure. "Now you see her," said Miss Betsy. My mother, after vainly trying to restrain herself, began to cry. "Oh, tut, tut, tut," said Miss Betsy. "Don't do that. Come, come, take off your cap, child, and let me see you." My mother did as she was told, and her hair, which was luxuriant and beautiful, fell all about her face. "Why, bless my heart," exclaimed Miss Betsy. "You are a very baby. Have some tea." "Do you think it will do me any good?" cried my mother. "Of course it will. What do you call your girl?" "I don't know that it will be a girl yet, ma'am," said my mother, innocently. "Bless the baby!" exclaimed Miss Betsy. "I don't mean that. I mean your servant."
"Peggotty," said my mother.
"Here, Peggotty!" cried Miss Betsy, opening the parlour door. "Tea! Your mistress is a little unwell. Don't dawdle!" Miss Betsy shut the door again and sat down with her feet on the fender. "You were speaking about its being a girl," said she. "I have no doubt it will be a girl. I have a presentiment that it must be a girl. Now, child, from the moment of the birth of the girl, I intend to be her friend. I intend to be her godmother, and I beg you'll call her Betsy Trotwood, Copperfield. There must be no mistakes in life with this Betsy Trotwood. She must be well brought up. I must make that my care."
Peggotty, coming in with the tea-board and candles, and seeing at a glance how ill my mother was, conveyed her upstairs to her own room with all speed, and immediately dispatched Ham Peggotty, her nephew, to fetch the nurse and doctor. The doctor, Mr. Chillip, having satisfied himself that there was a probability of this unknown lady and himself having to sit there, face to face, for some hours, laid himself out to be polite and social. He was soon called upstairs. After some quarter of an hour's absence, he returned.
"Well?" said my aunt.
"Well, ma'am," returned Mr. Chillip, we are progressing slowly, ma'am."
"Ba-a-a," said my aunt.
Mr. Chillip sat and looked at her for nearly 2 hours as she sat looking at the fire, until he was again called out. After another absence, he again returned.
"Well?" said my aunt.
"Well, ma'am," returned Mr. Chillip, we are progressing slowly, ma'am."
"Ya-a-a,"
said my aunt, with such a snarl at him that Mr. Chillip absolutely could not bear it. He preferred to go and sit upon the stairs. At 12:30, Mr. Chillip sidled into the parlour and said to my aunt in his meekest manner,
"Well, ma'am, I am happy to congratulate you. All is now over, ma'am, and well over."
My aunt eyed him narrowly. "How is she?"
"Well, ma'am, she will soon be quite comfortable, I hope," returned Mr. Chillip. "Quite as comfortable as we can expect a young mother to be under these circumstances."
"And she? How is she?" said my aunt sharply. "The baby? How is she?"
"It's a boy," returned Mr. Chillip.
My aunt said never a word, but took her bonnet by the strings, in the manner of a sling, aimed a blow at Mr. Chillip's head with it, put it on, bent, walked out, and never came back. She vanished like a discontented fairy. The first objects that assume a distinct presence before me, as I look far back into the blank of my infancy, are my mother, with her pretty hair and youthful shape, and Peggotty, with no shape at all, and eyes so dark that they seem to darken their whole neighbourhood in her face, and cheeks and arms so hard and red that I wondered the birds didn't peck her in preference to apples. Peggotty and I were sitting one night by the parlour fire, alone. I had been reading about crocodiles. I was tired of reading and dead sleepy, but having leave as a high treat to sit up until my mother came home from spending the evening at a neighbour's, I would rather have died upon my post than have gone to bed. When the garden bell rang, we went out to the door, and there was my mother looking unusually pretty, I thought, and with her a gentleman with beautiful black hair and whiskers who had walked home with us from church last Sunday. As my mother stooped down on the threshold to take me in her arms and kiss me, the gentleman said I was a more highly privileged little fellow than a monarch, or something like that. He patted me on the head, but somehow I didn't like him or his deep voice, and I was jealous that his hand should touch my mother's in touching me, which it did. I put it away as well as I could. "Oh, Davy," remonstrated my mother.
"Dear boy," said the gentleman, "I cannot wonder at his devotion."
My mother gently chid me for being rude, and turned to thank the gentleman for taking so much trouble as to bring her home.
"Let us say good night, my fine boy," said the gentleman, when he had bent his head over my mother's little glove.
"Good night," said I. Gradually I became used to seeing the gentleman with the black whiskers. He was called Mr. Murdstone. I liked him no better than at first, and had the same uneasy jealousy of him. About 2 months afterwards, we were sitting, as before, one evening, when my mother was out, as before, when Peggotty said, "Master Davy, how should you like to go along with me and spend a fortnight at my brother's at Yarmouth? Is your brother an agreeable man, Peggotty?" "Oh, what an agreeable man he is! Then there's the sea, and the boats and ships, and the fishermen, and the beach, and Am to play with. But what would my mother say?" "Why, I'll as good as bet a guinea that she'll let us go. I'll ask her, if you like, as soon as ever she comes home. There now." "But what's she to do while we're away?" said I. "She can't live by herself." "Oh, bless you. Don't you know? She's going to stay for a fortnight with Mrs. Graper. Mrs. Graper's going to have a lot of company." Oh, if that was it, I was quite ready to go. I waited in the utmost impatience until my mother came home to ascertain if we could get leave to carry out this great idea. Without being nearly so much surprised as I expected, my mother entered into it readily, and it was all arranged that night. The day soon came for our going. We were to go in a carrier's cart which departed in the morning after breakfast. The carrier's horse was the laziest horse in the world, and shuffled along with his head down, as if he liked to keep people waiting. The carrier also had a way of keeping his head down, and of dropping sleepily forward as he drove, with one of his arms on each of his knees. And as to conversation, he had no idea of it but whistling. Peggotty had a basket of refreshments on her knee, which would have lasted us out handsomely if we'd been going to London by the same conveyance. We ate a good deal and slept a good deal, and I was quite tired and very glad when we saw Yarmouth.
"Here's my Am, growed out of knowledge," cried Peggotty, when the carrier set us down.
Ham was a huge, strong fellow of 6 feet high, broad in proportion and round-shouldered, but with a boy's face and curly light hair that gave him quite a sheepish look. With Ham carrying me on his back and a small box of ours under his arm, and Peggotty carrying another small box of ours, we turned down lanes bestrewn with bits of chips and little hillocks of sand, until we came out upon the dull waste I had already seen at a distance, when Ham said, "Yon's our house, Master Davy." I looked in all directions, as far as I could stare over the wilderness, and away at the sea, and away at the river, but no house could I make out. There was a black barge, or some other kind of superannuated boat, not far off, high and dry on the ground, with an iron funnel sticking out of it for a chimney, and smoking very cosily. But nothing else in the way of a habitation. "That ship-looking thing?"
"That's it, Master Davy," returned Ham.
"If it had been Aladdin's palace, rock's egg and all, I suppose I could not have been more charmed with the romantic idea of living in it. There was a delightful door cut in the side, and it was roofed in, and there were little windows in it. But the wonderful charm of it was that it was a real boat, which had no doubt been upon the water hundreds of times, and which had never been intended to be lived in on dry land. It was beautifully clean inside, and as tidy as possible." Peggotty opened a little door and showed me my bedroom. It was the completest and most desirable bedroom ever seen, in the stern of the vessel, with a little window where the rudder used to go through, a little looking-glass, just the right height for me, nailed against the wall, and framed with oyster shells, a little bed, and a nosegay of seaweed in a blue mug on the table. We were welcomed by a very civil woman in a white apron, likewise by a most beautiful little girl with a necklace of blue beads on, who wouldn't let me kiss her when I offered to, but ran away and hid herself. By and by, a hairy man with a very good-natured face came home. As he called Peggotty Lass and gave her a hearty smack on the cheek, I had no doubt that he was her brother. And so he turned out, being presently introduced to me as Mr. Peggotty, the master of the house.
"Glad to see you, sir," said Mr. Peggotty. "You'll find us rough, sir, but you'll find us ready."
My time with the Peggottys was a happy one, varied by nothing but the variation of the tide, which altered Mr. Peggotty's times of going out and coming in, and altered Ham's engagements also. When the latter was unemployed, he sometimes walked with us to show us the boats and ships, and once or twice he took us for a row. I never hear the name, or read the name, of Yarmouth, but I'm reminded of a certain Sunday morning on the beach, the bells ringing for church, little Emily leaning on my shoulder, Ham lazily dropping stones into the water, and the sun, away at sea, just breaking through the heavy mist and showing us the ships like their own shadows. At last, the day came for going home. I bore up against the separation from Mr. Peggotty and Mrs. Gummidge, but my agony of mind at leaving little Emily was piercing. We went arm in arm to the public house where the carrier put up, and I promised, on the road, to write to her.